we're doing this. So one sort of easy way to do this, if you haven't done this before, is just to Google it, wait, and conveniently, right, first result, it's that documentation. And this one, I have to say, is not the maybe the most, I don't think this is the easiest of these documentations to read for weight PID, but if we do scroll down, there's a paragraph here that starts, the value of options, right, is an or of zero, so we could use sort of no options, that's our zero case, or we can use any number of these following constants. And so these are basically just bit indexes, bit fields, and we have a couple options here that we can use. I think generally we don't need to use these, sort of be in special cases, but just sort of to give you sort of an example of when we have a system call and it's got extra arguments we don't usually use all the time, the way to do this is to like look up this documentation and have to actually sort of read through these. And it's very common to have to do that and not just expect that you're going to memorize all of these cases. Okay, so I trust that all of you have sort of looked at this documentation in the past, but just another example of doing that. Okay, so let's look at an example here. Right, this is sort of our common structure. We've called fork, okay? And that's now returned twice. We can inspect the return argument, right? If that is greater than zero, then this is telling us what the child PID is, so this must be the parent. And if we get zero, then we're in the child, right? And so pretty much anytime you see fork, you're gonna see an if statement just like that, because we really do need to separate out these cases. Okay, and then here's our weight. So the parent process will not proceed beyond this until the child process has exited. Good with that? Any questions? Okay. So we used our sort of no options, but we do pass in a reference to status. So this lets weight populate our variable status with what sort of what happened. Now, where does status come from? Well, if we look at an example program, typically, right, this is sort of like the simplest example of just a main function that returns zero. And so this value here is the status. Now, return zero is going to do effectively the same thing as if we hit called exit explicitly, right? But that's sort of part of where that what that status is. And so this is a way for our child process to communicate at least a little bit of information about sort of what happened. Typically, zero means everything was fine, and some other number might mean something went wrong. So, but that's not all that status is. So this is part of it. We also get additional information that the child process itself can't really tell us. And so if we look at a more complete example, again, here's our weight, right? So we're sort of zooming in. We just called weight. When weight returns, we know that the process has exited. We got our status information. Now, that status information is going to have not just that value from the child process, but also some additional information. We can access that information rather than sort of have to know exactly how this works manually with these macros. So there's a couple here. So if we want to check, did this process, the child process, sort of return kind of normally? Like it just sort of exited or returned from main? Well, if that's the case, then this macro will effectively return true, right? This one being right here. And we can print something for that. Otherwise, we can check, was this process sort of killed by a signal? If so, this macro will sort of return true, and we can check that. And so we get both that return value and sort of why that child process exited. And again, these are just sort of helper macros that are defined for us, so we don't have to remember exactly where in that status integer these flags are set. All right, yes?
The WIF exited is just if it exits with an integer and the status is returns if it's been exited with a signal and then tells you what signal it was killed with, or what does that refer to?
Okay, so we actually have, so the question is sort of what are these doing? So we have three of these, right? We have exited, status, and signaled. So exited is going to tell us, it's a Boolean. Did this process, child process, exit because of a sort of normal exit? It returned from main, or it called exit, or not? Then we have signaled, which will tell us, did this child process exit because it was killed by a signal, or not? And then if it's a normal exit, then we expect that we got that return, like, for example, return let's say negative one. This value we can get here. This whole thing. Right, and so then we can actually print that status code that was returned from the process. So again, it's just helper macros to extract that from that integer. Yeah?
So does the status like just automatically update based off of if you're using like exit or return, like that affects the status pointer?
Does the status automatically update depending on...
Yeah, just like, is that automatically updated or is that you have to like actually hard code?
So basically how does status get set, I think is generally the question. So remember this wait PID is a system call. And so that system call is being handled by the operating system. And so the operating system is going to handle this for us, right? So if the process called exit, that's it's another system call, so that value will get recorded by the operating system, and then if we called wait, like we did here, the operating system then can have that, and it can also set these flags, and then set whatever pointer we provided here, this reference to status, with that information. So as application programmers, our code is just gonna look like this, or if we're writing the program, right, we'll just use sort of our normal return, and the operating system will connect these for us. Okay. So, put together, where are we? We kind of go back to our picture that we had, our sort of typical pattern, and now we have this way to wait. And so this allows the parent process to fork and then wait. The child process is going to do whatever it's supposed to do. Eventually it calls exit. And at some point then this wait will return in the parent process and we can handle it from there. And while we're not necessarily familiar with this from sort of calling these system calls and actually setting this up, although you will be when we do the homework, we are sort of very familiar with this at sort of a operational point of view, because this is basically exactly what a shell is doing for us, right? The shell is the parent process. When we want to run a command, we type it in. The shell forks, runs whatever command we asked it to as the child process, and just sort of waits for that to finish. And then when that command process, whatever program exits and finishes, then the shell goes back and lets us run another one. Right? So we've been interacting with this control flow loop all the time. Now we're sort of seeing under the hood of how it's implemented. Another example of this could look sort of slightly different, where it's okay if the parent also maybe has some work to do. So it's not just immediately just trying to wait. Maybe it has some operation it wants to do while there's a child process that's also executing. And then at some point it's like, okay, now I need to know when that child process is finished. And so I'm going to call wait now. And if that happens afterwards, that's okay. So this is just sort of same exact program structure, just sort of a slightly different intent. And this will function correctly as well. Now, the same structure, but with annotations of the code here. So here we sort of, our starting point is here. Again, this is our fork call. And again, we're going to see this sort of pattern over and over, right? If and else if. So if we're zero, exec, and then otherwise wait. So what does this arrow represent? What's running over here? What does the side represent? The upper box? Child, yeah. Yeah. So this is the child sort of depicted here, and then what does that mean? This has to be
parents.
Yes. So as we continue sort of in this diagram here, and the parent is executing wait, the child's executing exec, and then eventually when we call exec, now we're running this new program, right? Whatever main that is. What questions do you have? Yeah.
So when the, like in the alternate version of this, when the parent process is doing some work while the child process is happening, is there anything that, like for lack of a better term, we shouldn't do in the parent while the child is running, or?
Okay.
Is there anything that would interfere with the child and within the parent program running that would mess things up?
So if we go back to this picture real quick, so in this case, the parent is sort of depicted as doing some additional computation or work or something in the meantime, right? That was kind of this red arrow here and the thread executing. Is there anything that we shouldn't do there? Something, because we've added this additional fork, this additional child process, there's something that maybe would be bad, right? That would cause some interactions. And if I have to guess, this is sort of coming from this idea because we looked at signals, right, between processes and how that can have sort of these interesting safety issues. Any thoughts? Yeah.
Memory allocation.
Okay, so what about memory allocation, right? Is there something about if we're maybe using malloc or doing something in the parent process, would that sort of have some effect? And the answer is no. And this is sort of the beauty of the process abstraction, is just like any two processes, whether it's sort of the forked child process, or it's a process that your user, that you started executing on the same machine that I happen to be logged into as well, right? We have this isolation between processes. Now, they start with a very, now in this case, right, the parent and child, right, they start with a very common set of everything, right, because they're copies. But after that, after they start executing, they sort of, they get their own memory, they can allocate their own memory, and sure, you could run out of system memory, and maybe that could cause some problems. And that would be true of any two processes on the same machine. Yeah?
What about if they're reading or writing to the same file?
Ah, okay. What if they're reading or writing to the same file? So that's a more nuanced example, right? Where essentially there's a resource, and again, because they're copied, they might have access to the same, or sort of, we'll talk about that a little bit more. And there could be some contention there if they're sort of accessing the same file. Again, I guess in a sense, yes, that could lead to some issues. But it's also the case that that could lead to issues with any two processes. If any two processes had access to the same resources. So I think kind of part of the intuition here is that because these are sort of separate processes, we get a lot of the same, we get the same guarantees that we did with other sort of process abstraction. Now, there is sort of one example that kind of comes to mind where, and this isn't necessarily because they're forked, but certainly we talked about signals, right? If the parent process decides to send like the kill signal to the child, right? That is certainly going to interrupt the child process. And that might be necessary because maybe the child process isn't exiting. Like maybe this never happened and we want to stop it. And so in a shell, we would do control C, but as we learned before, programs can catch the control C sort of sig int, and so it still might not exit, and so we might have to upgrade to a signal that the program, the child process can't block or can't mask or can't handle. I think that would certainly be interfere with the other process. Other questions? Yeah.
You need to fork for an exec because it like kind of removes the previous process, right? Or like, because you can't just like write it like linearly. Would that be true?
I think, yeah, so the question is sort of why do we kind of have this common paradigm of there's a fork and then we exec? And I think your reasoning is spot on that. Exec is sort of like a one-way thing. Like we go, we run the new program, and the old one's gone. And so if we want any ability to kind of come back or run another thing or handle the status code, we need something that can do that. And fork gives us that because now we can use the parent process for that. Otherwise, everything's just kind of gone. Now, we don't, strictly speaking, like, have to, right? We can write a process and just exec, or write a program and just exec. That would be fine. It's just not always useful. Okay. So this kind of is sort of the quite a fair bit of our process management API that we need to be able to write these kinds of programs and create new processes effectively. It also sort of lets us implement a shell. And you know, we've seen these different system calls. All right, so now that we've looked at wait, let's see if we can reason about what would happen if we actually wrote a sort of full program with wait. And so here we have just sort of one main function. We're calling fork, and then we're waiting. And the question is, assuming that the fork and exec succeed, which is definitely the common case, what are the outputs that we could expect? So let's take maybe 3 minutes, talk to your neighbors. What are the possible outputs?
Plus I means it means that then rise instead of rise that increment, right? One of them are valid, at least. Well, just like running through is like, if it's parent that's me, the PIDS I equals 0 wouldn't be valid.
Who would like more time? Okay, take another minute.
The for loop exactly. I don't
All right. Any takers for A? Okay. How about B? Okay. C? I guess that, what about D? Okay. Maybe some people are holding out for D or E. Okay. And F? All right. So, few for A. Few for E, and a couple others. Few for B, I think. So, what's going to happen here? What are we looking at? So first, understand this. We're in a loop here, right? So this is going to run twice, and in that loop, we're calling fork. Okay. So the first iteration through, I will be 0, and That just means we're indexing this PIDs array at zero. Now, after fork, again, forks and returns twice. So once in the parent, once in the child. This if statement, right, that's our same if statement that we've been seeing over and over again. And we're checking for zero, so that means that if this if is true, we must be in the child process. And that's kind of what we expect, because eventually then we call exec, we're calling echo, and we're going to echo with these args, which is sort of L1. Okay, so we have one process, which is a child process that we created, and we're execing echo with L1. All right, cool. Now, in the parent process, the loop is going to happen again, right? This if statement didn't match, so this didn't happen in the child process. Sorry. This if didn't match in the parent process, meaning we just continue with our loop like normal. Now I is 1, we do the same thing over again, except now when the child process is spawned from fork, it uses the second argument, right? So now we have a second child process because we called fork twice. This one's going to echo L2. And so just kind of get a sense of what this code is doing, that's kind of intuitively what you would expect. Now the question is, what happens in those child processes? So each child called exec, and particularly we are interested, I guess, in the first child process, right? Because I is a variable, but it's the child process is a direct copy. So the child process has I, it's also 0. The child process uses it. This exec, what happens when that finishes? Right, yeah.
Wouldn't it still go to the next for loop, or?
Okay, would it go back to this for loop, right? Does this essentially return to here, and then we continue the for loop? And the answer is no. Exec is this like one way, I sort of think about it like akin to like just an unconditional jump instruction. We're executing this new program, we're getting rid of the program that we have, which is what we're looking at here, this whole main, that's gone now. We're just running this new thing, which is echo. When that calls exit, which it will after echoing that string, it's done. And so we're not going to execute this loop again. And that's going to happen in both child processes. So we're only going to execute this if statement, call exec, and then that child process is now a new program, and that's it. The parent will go to this for loop here, and it will wait for both of the child processes to finish. And what that means is sort of, again, this will sort of execute, we'll do 2 echo execs. Now the question is there some ordering here? So we started, because we did a for loop here, I was 0 and then I was 1. So we started the processes in a certain order, but again, the operating system doesn't guarantee us which order it's actually going to execute those. So it very well may execute actually the second child process first, and then the first one, or vice versa. And so we can get sort of this outcome or this one here. And so we expect that E will, or E is our sort of our possible outputs. Any questions on that? Yeah.
Why doesn't echo do a new line again, like after L2?
Right, so like, why isn't there a new line here? This is just to fit it on the slide. So normally we would put L2 below L1 to sort of indicate that, like it's printing multiple lines. So the new line here is just to, in between here, both echoes will do the same thing. This is just an artifact of the slide. Yeah.
I'm a bit confused by assuming for a exec we do not fail. Is there anything in this that would make them fail, or is it just would their failure be reliant on like external circumstances outside this program?
Hmm. So we're assuming that fork and exec do not fail. Is that a reasonable assumption? When could fork and exec fail? I think that's sort of a version of your question. In a sense, sort of this code is doing the right thing. It's not handling those cases if these did fail. But there's sort of nothing kind of unusual about this. But what's one example of why these fork or exec could fail? Yeah.
If it received a signal.
If it received a signal. So if what receives a signal?
Like the program, like in the middle of it.
Mm.
Like it received control C or something.
Okay. So if the process received a signal, that would interrupt the process. But that wouldn't mean that fork or exec failed. So when we say fork and exec failed, we mean the system calls fail. Those system calls would have succeeded, just the process would be interrupted somehow. Yeah?
Would it be like you're out of memory somehow?
Sure. So if fork tries to sort of allocate this new process structure, but there's no more room for new processes. I think there was a question last time about like essentially what if you just keep calling fork in a loop? That's really bad because eventually there's no more memory to have more processes. So that's a reason it could fail. Another idea? So right, we're execing with this string. Now we certainly assume that /bin/echo will be there. Right, but if it's not, then we can't really run that program. Okay, all right, so that's kind of our warm-up. Let's look at a slightly more complicated example. Same general flow, right? We have fork and a loop, we're calling exec. What are the outputs that can happen here? Take another 3 minutes.
Yeah, it can't be this because it's
right. Advanced child.
Okay. Any takers for A? How about B? C? D? E? Okay, there's everybody. All right, see, we're paying attention. F? All of the above? Or sort of none of these, something else. All right, so I think we had kind of overwhelming support for A, B, and C. And again, this sort of shows that the ordering is not guaranteed, with sort of a key exception, right? So here, again, we're running fork in a loop. We're calling running the echo program. Now, in this case, we're always using sort of zero as the argument. So all the child processes are going to echo zero. And we're running this loop two times. So we should expect to get two child processes. And just as before, once we call exec, right, that's just straight. We're running the new program. This program that we're seeing here is done. It's gone. And so we're not going to continue in that loop. And then the other sort of key point here is that the parent process is printing a 1. Now we have sort of three processes, two child processes that we forked, the parent process. Now the order that they run in is up to the OS. So if we look at C, for example, right, this is the OS let the parent process continue. It called this print with this 1, and then the two child processes executed after that. So we got this ordering. And we could have sort of other interleaving. So we could have one child process go, then the parent go, then the other child process, or both child processes, and the parent goes last. And that kind of gives us sort of these bit here. So again, this is kind of another one of these like subtleties that we sort of have to get used to, that we can see the code kind of in order, but once we've started a new process, we don't know exactly the order things will actually execute. Yeah?
So when you put null in for the status in the second loop for wait PID, that's like an effective like indefinite pause for those processes, so we never get to the printing 2?
Okay, so hold on. So I'm we're getting there. We're getting there. Okay. So that's kind of the sort of first structure. Now the question is, could this happen, right? Could we get the two kind of in the middle here? And the answer is no, because we have this for loop. And the for loop is doing the weight on each of our child processes. And so this for loop will not complete until both of our child processes have exited, meaning they've had a chance to print. And then only then will the parent process print two. And so that means we need that to be last. Now, there was a question about, okay, what's this null doing here? And in general, this is just, we don't care what the status was. Like, this is the parent saying, I mean, whatever you returned and whatever reason that you exited, I don't frankly care. And so don't even bother telling me. And the OS would be like, okay, if you pass a null pointer in here, then I just won't tell you what that was. Otherwise, the wait PID works just as it did before. And so that will give us our sort of our answer of A, B, and C. Other questions? Yeah?
If we knew that this was running on like a single core, then would the system call from fork guarantee that one of the children would run before the second one's created?
Yeah, so if we knew that we were on a single core, we could even say single threaded machine, sort of a simple processor, if you will, would then calling fork and creating the child process, would that guarantee us a bit of ordering? Because now we know that there's no way for the parent and the child to run simultaneously, like literally at the exact same time. They have to sort of share the same core. And the answer is still no. Because the operating system has to make a decision which thing gets access to that resource, that execution core, and it could choose either one. Yeah.
So when we fork each time in the for loop, the PID in the array becomes the PID of the child. So then if we wanted to, instead of doing a loop, could we just have it so one child PID is we call with wait PID such that only maybe we can like order the child like can we like order can we try and control whether or not which child gets printed first or not?
Okay, so we have the process IDs of the child processes, right? That's what we're storing in this array. And the question is, could we use that somehow to try to control the ordering that this execution happens? And the answer is yes, and we kind of can see that already. So right now we're doing this entire for loop where we do the forks first, and then we're calling wait for all of the processes we created. What if instead of that, we just called fork one time for the first child process, then called wait, let that child process finish, then call fork again, run the second child process, let wait for that one to finish, and then we do our print two. Right? So waiting is absolutely a tool that would let us order this. We just would have to sort of set this up slightly differently so we don't sort of do the fork in a loop without a wait for it, or in between. Now, same question. Okay, now that we have these PIDs in this array and we have this loop, is there something we could do at this point? Like if we didn't modify the first bit of this program, but then right here we wanted to modify something? No. Right, those are processes they're executing. We don't have control over sort of how they execute at that point. Other questions? Yeah.
How long does it like store the return value of child process?
how
how long will the OS store the child process or the return values of the child process? I don't know that I have a great answer. Charles, do you have a good answer to that?
Until something waits for it.
Until something waits for it. Okay.
If the parent process exits, it gets reparented to a system process that waits for it. If you look in the right log file, you could find the exit status process.
Yeah, so if the parent here were to exit but the child was still executing, then that child would be reassigned to a new parent. But so the operating system is just going to kind of hold on to that. What else? All right, all good? And I think it's certainly it's good practice to be here sort of thinking through these. This can really sort of help get that intuition. If it's still a little bit like, okay, I kind of get it, but I also, it's kind of confusing, that's okay. Like we said, this is a very strange system call. It's sort of hard to think about these different interleavings. It takes some practice, it takes some experience to do that. That's why we practice these things, why we have the lecture and the labs and the homework, to help you sort of gain the intuition. So if you're feeling like, I can see it, like once you explain it, I kind of get it, but it's still a little confusing, that's okay. It will sort of come with time. Okay. So, what we've seen so far is how we can start to build the kinds of interactions that shells are doing that we've been interacting with, like I was saying, all this time, and we've been using these mechanisms but not really understanding how they work under the hood. Well, now we're starting to see that. And so some things that shells will do for us, right, is find programs. So we just typically call ls. We don't think about that that's not a real file path and that it's actually stored somewhere. The shell will do that sort of lookup for us, which is very nice, assuming that we've told it where we should look for executables. We can also run programs in the background. So same thing as normal, run the program, and then adding an ampersand is the flag to shells to say, I want you to run this, but I don't want to sort of wait for its output. I just want to be able to go do something else. So we can run it in the background. Now, what's interesting about this is actually, like, this is like the really easy case, right? This is just fork, let the child run, and whatever, done with that, let that go, and I'll just go back to being a shell. It's actually a little bit more complicated what we've been seeing with the wait to do it with the normal case without the ampersand. Then there's redirection. So again, we're still running our program, but now we're saying, we can say, instead of printing to the terminal and sort of showing the user, write output to a file. In this case, output.txt. Or rather than wait for me to sort of type in input on the terminal, read it in from a file. Right? And we've done this in sort of our, you know, when we're using the shell. And now we can look at, well, how is it actually that we can actually implement this? And a sort of a similar but slightly different example are creating pipelines. And so here we're piping the output of this program as the input to a new program, to another program, I should say. So we can run both of these programs and actually chain or pipe their input, or pipe the output from one into the input of the other. And that's with this pipe syntax. And again, we can sort of see now how we can implement that. To do this, we need the notion of a file descriptor. Now, we've been using file descriptors when writing C programs for a long time. We can try to be a little bit more precise about what's actually happening here. So what we're showing here is a process info struct. And this is stored in memory somewhere. And this is that same struct that we've been kind of saying of like, wait a minute, where is this stuff stored if we're doing an exception or a context switch? Well, we're going to have some object in memory somewhere which contains this. In addition to sort of register state, we also have a file description table. Here it's called files. And this is for every process is going to have this. And this is basically just a record keeping in the kernel of the open files for that particular process, open file descriptions. Now, you may have heard sort of in Unix, everything is a file. This sort of helps, and the reason for that is it makes this abstraction very powerful. So a file, in this case, can be a lot of different things. It could be access to the terminal, could be a networking socket, could be an actual like thing we would typically call a file, like stored in a file system somewhere, or a pipe, as we saw in the previous slide. And so here we're storing the structure of all of those descriptions, and then our file descriptor is the index into that array. And this is what we use with our system calls. So if we pass in file descriptor of, 114, because that's the file descriptor we're using for a particular open file, and we want to read from that, that's what we would pass in. And so this kind of provides a nice abstraction so that we don't have to pass this entire object, whatever this open file description is, to the operating system, to the kernel. We can just pass the index into this structure as the file descriptor. So file descriptor indexes into our table or array of file descriptions. Now, where do we get file descriptors? Well, we've sort of seen this already, right? We've definitely used these. So open, probably the most common example. So if we open a particular file, what we get back, right, that's a file descriptor. So that's, again, that's an index into that table provided by the operating system. That's for sort of regular files, but a lot of other things in Unix systems will use this as well. So if we have shared memory, we want to set up shared memory between processes, file descriptor. If we open a networking socket, like we'll see later in the semester, file descriptor. A pseudo terminal, file descriptor, and pipe, which we'll see on Thursday, file descriptor. So this same abstraction is really powerful and gets used over and over. All right, so we're getting to, okay, why is this important to understand right now? Now, we can get file descriptors this way. There's also some others that we've used, right? We use all the time. Maybe we don't even think about that we're using them, right? These are these special file descriptors. So for standard input, which is given file descriptor 0, standard output 1, standard error file descriptor 2. To sort of make this a little bit more readable in code, so we don't just have like the number 1 somewhere, which can be hard to like, wait, why 1? Well, there's constants defined for us, right, that we can use in our code. And so when we're using printf, right, under the hood, it's just using the standard output file descriptor. We could sort of do this more explicitly, and we've seen some examples in the slides where we're sort of explicitly writing to a particular file descriptor. Now, we'll get back to exactly how these come to be, because these are sort of fixed, but in general, open returns with a file descriptor, we don't get to tell it which file descriptor we want. But we'll see how we can sort of manipulate this. And just to kind of round out this discussion, so if we opened a file, we can close a file as well. And what's the argument to that? Well, a file descriptor. Now, what's happening here is not always exactly what intuition would tell us. So we're closing the file descriptor, meaning that index into the array, that file descriptions array, is no longer valid. So we're deallocating that index. But if something else also was sort of open to the same place, the same file, that or more specifically was the same file description, but just under a different file descriptor, that is not closed. In a lot of cases, this is not, we don't really have to think about this. Because in a normal program, we call open, we use that file descriptor, we close it. That would be the only instance of that file description. But with fork, right now we copy things. And we have parent and child processes. We want to be able to set up these redirections. In this case, we're going to start to have these copies of these file descriptions. Now, if, however, we close the last descriptor for something, then those resources are deallocated. So it's okay. If nothing is holding file descriptor to this thing, we don't need to keep that around anymore. And typically, right, we get zero on success as per usual, but we couldn't get an error if, for example, we ran out of space. Yeah.
Will a file always have the same file descriptor if you were to like open and close it multiple times?
Will a file have the same file descriptor if we were to do an open, we get a file descriptor, then we close, and then we call open again, will we get the same file descriptor every time? And the answer is no, not necessarily. Right? That's why we have to sort of keep track of that return value from open, because the operating system may use a different file descriptor. Okay, so if we go back to this notion of redirection, with file descriptors, we can start to implement this. So for example, if we want to take something from input, so we're running a program that we wrote, and in the shell, we're putting the angle bracket, opening angle bracket, and then a file name. And we're instructing the shell to say, when you run this program, take the contents of input.txt and provide that as standard in. And so this would be akin to if you ran the program like normal without the redirection, and then sort of pasted the entire contents of this file in yourself. Right? Because that's sort of setting the standard in. Conversely, the output sort of looks exactly the same, except we flip the angle bracket and say, when we run this command, this program, instead of the output going to standard out and being printed in the terminal, write it to this file. And this is, again, akin to if we had taken whatever was printed in the terminal, copied that, and then just put it into a file ourselves. But telling the shell to do this. Does the sort of high-level goal make sense? Okay. So how can we enable this? Well, we use some important properties of the system calls we've seen. So first, the shell, right, is going to call fork. That's how it's going to start a new process to run a new program. And fork does this sort of full deep copy, except for the ID, right? So we get a new ID for the child process, but the memory is copied. And importantly, the file description table is copied. Okay. And so if we had open file descriptions in the parent, like to write to standard out, then those also exist in the child. And And so this way the child process has access to those same resources, like being able to print to the terminal. But we want to do more than that. We want to be able to do something like redirect the output to not go to the terminal, but to actually go to a file. Right? And so we could do this by setting things up after we do the fork, but before we do the exec. And the reason is because when we call fork, we get the copy, but then we can do that little bit of setup before we call exec. Now, exec doesn't keep the memory because we wouldn't want the new program to run with our parent program's memory, but it does preserve the file descriptors, that file description table. And so in effect, we have this little window, right, between when we call fork and we call exec, where we can configure things so that when that new program starts running, instead of standard out being sort of the conventional go to the terminal, we can set it to be a new file descriptor, which is the output file. And so because we use the same interface, whether we're writing to standard out in the terminal or standard out that's actually a file, we can, after fork, open a file in the child process. We'll open a file for the redirect. And then we can assign them to be standard out. And we'll talk about the duplicate or dupe2 library call on Thursday to do that. And then we call exec. And so now we've configured how the sort of environment looks like for the new program that we're going to run so that we get these interactions that we want. Any questions on that so far? Okay, so when your program is sort of outputting, if we want to output somewhere else, are we sort of always just outputting and it'd be file descriptor one for like standard out, or are we sort of doing something else? And the answer is we're always going to use file descriptor one. We're just going to change what that means in effect. So file descriptor one, rather than sort of outputting to the terminal, is now going to output to a file. And if we configure it in our child process before we call exec, we do that correctly, the program we're trying to run doesn't change, right? It doesn't know whether it's outputting to a terminal or to a file, or at least it doesn't have to know. It's going to operate the exact same way. Other questions? All right, we will pick up here on Thursday. Thanks, everyone.